Thanks for taking the time to download this BBC Radio 5 Live podcast. To search for other podcasts you might like, click bbc.co.uk/5live, where you'll also find our terms of use.
We're looking at the world of gadgets and all things technical for the next hour. If you've ever pondered to upgrade or not to upgrade, switched off that machine and switched it on again and still nothing's working, then the man to talk to is Fevzi Turkalp from the website gadgetdetective.com. If your gadget is working and you want to talk about another one, you can call us on 0500 909 693. You can text us on 85058. Get in touch via social media, the address at BBC5Live, or you can email us at upallnight@bbc.co.uk. Hi there, Fevzi.
Morning.
Hi, how are things this week?
Yeah, good. Some interesting stories. We've been looking at this story about Facebook. Have admitted or boasted, depending upon your view of things, that they're using artificial intelligence to scan our posts onto the Facebook website and app and try and work out what it is we're talking about. And, you know, various potential uses for that. They say, well, it's good for getting rid of posts that represent spam, for example, but it's also quite useful if they want to, if they notice, for example, that you're talking about planning a trip, they can offer you travel services, anything that pertains to what you're talking about. It's a bit worrying. I mean, it follows on a few days ago from another story where people realized, and it's been the case for at least a couple of years, that Facebook can turn on the microphone in the app, the Facebook app, so that it can actually listen to what's being said in the vicinity of the microphone. Now, the original idea behind that was that they could listen into the background and work out what music you're listening to or what TV show is on in the background and use that to suggest that you message about that. But of course, if it can pick up the background, it can also pick up what's being spoken about in the foreground. So this is something, it's not unique to Facebook, but you know, companies like Facebook and Google are increasingly finding smarter, artificially intelligent ways of knowing who we are and what we're interested in. And you know, they famously say that Google will know your daughter's pregnant before you do, and
yes.
And probably who the father is as well, by mm-hmm. the way. But that's no lie, and it's interesting when you think about it in terms of privacy and whether actually the fight for our privacy is essentially lost, that in exchange for these conveniences of having, you know, these artificial assistants, these bots that can go off and do our bidding and know what we want before we articulate it and before we even know it ourselves sometimes, and help us with those things, that in exchange for that must die to a large extent the whole concept of privacy, that we cease to be private entities, but we become public property.
You mentioned Google there. It always seems to know when I'm on my way home. It just, you get into the car, you look at your phone, and it says you'll take 20 minutes to get home. Traffic is normal right now. How does it know that? How does it know I'm going home?
Well, I mean, again, it's not just, oh, it's got a GPS chip, so it knows your location, but it will have noticed, for example, that when you go to a particular location at approximately a certain time of day or certain days of the week, it will work out a pattern, rather like a criminal who wants to know what your movements are going to be. It will work it out. But the hope is that, you know, it's benign, and it's doing it through, you know, Google now pulling together all these bits of information, like a really good PA, let's be more generous, like a really good PA who will just know what you want and give it to you. So it will have worked out, you know, from this location you tend to go home, and therefore it won't wait for you to say, you know, like you do into a dumb sat nav, as it were, take me home, how do I get there. It will know, or it will have a reasonable guess. It's similarly in a smart house. You know, a smart house will notice that when you sit in a particular armchair, you tend to switch on the light beside the armchair, so it will turn it on for you. You can see the benefit of that, but you know, one has to ask, is that the future we want? And even if it isn't, can we now stop it?
How do you think people feel? I mean, there's been a sort of, the widespread feeling is that, and largely from privacy campaigners who've said that, oh, it's all going to be horrendous. And then but we volunteer this information. We give it to Google and to Facebook anyway. And so are people just accepting of it?
Look, there is a degree to which we volunteer it. You know, people will say, people will give away the most personal secrets about themselves in return for free use of an app, you know, and it's not free. If there's no obvious product, the rule of thumb is you are the product, and it's not free. But I think many people don't realize exactly what information is being bled out from the apps that they're using. And in particular, this Google changed their... I don't want to just concentrate on Google, but it's a good example for this, because Google provides many and varied services, and it changed its terms and conditions, I think a couple of years back now, to allow them to combine the data that they gather on an individual from all these different services. So, you know, be it Google Maps or be it, you know, the Google search engine, it could combine them. And the combination of a vast amount of individually innocuous pieces of information allows Google to form a very detailed image of who we are, what we are, what we believe in, what our values are, all of these sorts of things. It's a bit like when the security services say, well, we don't listen to the contents of calls, but we only the metadata. But actually, the metadata is really powerful, and that's what Google are doing. They're collecting metadata. And a bit more when they start scanning the contents of your emails, as is the case with Gmail, for example. So a free email account, you don't have to pay for it. You know, if you wanted a high quality email account, typically, you'd have to pay at least a few tens of pounds for that a year. With Gmail, you get it for free. But the price of that is that they scan the contents of your email and provide you with advertising that is appropriate, and you may see that as a benefit, better than seeing advertising that you have no interest in, arguably. But what else will that information be used for? Google were recently given access to medical records of patients in three London hospitals, again to try and come up with something that's going to benefit us medically. But it seems that the limits on how that information can be used is somewhat woolly.
Yeah, absolutely. I read an interesting quote online earlier this week. It was on Facebook, and it said something, I can't quote it completely verbatim, but it said something along the lines of, George Orwell failed to predict that we'd own the cameras and we'd be more worried when people weren't watching. There's something in that, isn't there?
Yeah, it's. I tend to think, you know, there was this belief that the families of people shot in China were made to pay for the bullets that killed their children, and it's a bit like that. We're paying hundreds of pounds for very sophisticated bugging devices. I mean, who would have thought it? You know, the smartphone is the ultimate bugging device. It's got a GPS chip, tells you where you are. It's got a camera that can be switched on by stealth, a microphone that can be switched on without any tally light coming on to let you know the microphone is active, and we've paid for it. We pay monthly to keep it connected and allow ourselves to be tracked.
This is already a very deep technical discussion. It's very ethical. Maybe we should let's focus a bit more on sort of the usual stuff about repairs and recommendations. 0500 909 693 for your calls, 85058 for your texts, and email upallnight@bbc.co.uk for any questions you have for Febsy Turk out for the next 45 minutes or so on your tech phone in here on Up All Night. Delighted to say that Alan in Glasgow joins us as the first caller of the evening. Hi there, Alan.
Hi.
Hi there. Understand you need to buy a smartphone and a tablet. You're looking for a few recommendations.
Yeah, nobody in the country requires Fedsy's help more than me because nobody knows less about what they are doing than me. I've got a 15 or 16-year-old Siemens A60.
Right.
And the battery is finally dying, which is not surprising.
You've done now, well, Alan. You've done well with that for the battery to last.
Remarkably well, and
so long.
Very impressive phone. I'll tell you the problem. I have never used the computer. I intend going into my, when I've got the tablet, going into my library and using their free Wi-Fi to find out what I'm doing. The phones, I don't worship at the Church of Apple, unlike many people, and I think the products are overpriced. I've kind of decided on Samsung. I'm looking at two Samsung phones, the new J5 and the older, but much more professional S6. Now, there's a considerable difference in the cost of them. I was considering the Samsung Galaxy Tab S2, the 9.7-inch version, but I'm told that is being replaced by something new fairly soon. I intend buying them SIM-free to begin with, because I haven't got a clue how much data I am going to use. I intend getting the 321 from 3. I'm not interested in downloading films, music, box sets. I want an email address. I want to be able to use the BBC radio player. I want to be able to read the independent newspaper, which, as you know, has gone online only. And I want to be able to use OK Google. And that is it. And I would be intend buying a £20 voucher and finding out how long it lasts with the data. And if I need a contract, I'll buy a monthly contract. And as you can imagine, the shops, Carphone Warehouse in particular, only want to sell me a try and persuade me to get a contract. Well, I definitely don't want a contract. I know my own mind. I would like to hear your advice, which phone I should buy of the two, and whether that Tab is being replaced with a new model.
Right. Okay. So lots of questions and comments, and you've obviously done a lot of thinking about it. So you came on saying, actually, you don't know much about it, but actually, you've become an expert in your particular needs, which is
I'm an expert in the field without knowing how to work the stuff.
Well, that's to follow, but you've done a lot of the groundwork, so that's fine. I think the first thing is to think about, you know, whether you want to go for Android devices or Apple, and you've mentioned, you know, you don't want Apple. All I would say to you is that some of the Apple stuff is the entry level of some of it now is cheaper than it was, and
I have looked at the SE, but it's too small.
Yeah, I understand, but also bear in mind that there are certain issues relating to ease of use and safety, if you like, online safety, that gives Apple the edge. But having said that, you can make your Android devices, you know, almost equally.
I intend using it solely for the reasons I've mentioned. No way will I do a financial transaction on the net.
Right. Okay. Well, look, fair enough. In terms of the differences between the Samsung Galaxy J5 and the Samsung Galaxy S6, which I think were the two that you mentioned,
there's £190 difference in cost simply.
Yeah. So the S6 is a more recent device. It ships with a later version of the operating system on it. The screen is of a higher resolution. The camera built into the S6 is also better in terms of having not only a higher resolution, which isn't necessarily very important, but also what's called optical image stabilization. So if you were interested in the photography side, if you're interested in the resolution and the sharpness of the screen, then the S6 is the better camera. If you're only interested in doing things like FaceTime, you know, video calling and so forth, then not really much difference, because they've both got the same resolution of camera on the other side facing you. So not a huge difference. The other thing I would say is that the J5 has less memory built into it. I think it comes with a standard of 8 gigabytes, but it's got a memory card slot in it, so that you can expand that quite cheaply by plugging in micro SD cards, I think up to 128 gigabytes, whereas the S6 has got, I don't think it has a memory card slot, but it comes with memory up to 128 gigabytes. So if, for example, you wanted to put, you know, a lot of music and films on it when you're traveling, then
no, I don't. I want to use it solely for the purposes I mentioned.
I think, look, strictly for the purposes that you mentioned, the J5 is cheaper than the S6, and it will meet your needs. If you're not interested in the improved camera, If you're not interested in, you know, the optical stabilization, and why not go for the J5? And that does then give you the benefit of having the memory card slot as well.
That's what I feel, but as you can imagine, the shops want to sell me the more expensive stuff.
Yeah, but you're right to stick to your usage, keeping your usage in mind, and just bear in mind that there will be a difference in the crispness of the screens. But the answer to that is to just look at them in the shop side by side.
Yeah.
And frankly, some people it doesn't bother at all.
Bother me at all. I've tried that.
You've looked at it. Well, that's fine. I mean, there's a lot of people using sort of non-retina screens, as it were.
Yeah. I can't think of a reason not to go for the J5. And although it seems sort of primitive to a lot of people, going from the Siemens A60, which I'm sure you remember, it's kind of cutting-edge technology.
Yeah. I mean, the only other thing to be aware of is that with the J5 being the older machine, it will probably... The point at which it can no longer work with the very latest version of the Android operating system will probably come earlier than with the S6. But frankly, given the price differential between them, I would say you still go with the J5, keep the extra money in your pocket.
To learn the basics of what I'm doing, and then next time I can go for a better phone.
Yeah, exactly. So I think for that reason, the J5, and it's expandable with the memory card slot, I think you'd be more than happy.
That appealed to me as well. And am I correct? I'm going to be using very little data for the purposes I've mentioned.
Yeah, so the way to deal with that is... you're already going to be dealing with it correctly, because what you don't want to do is tie yourself into a contract which has a certain data allowance before you know what your likely data usage is going to be. So even if you'd said to me, Fevzi, you know, I'd like to have a contract, I'd say to you, maybe spend a month or two on a pay-as-you-go. This will give you a couple of benefits. One is it will allow you to work out what your typical usage will be, not only in terms of data, but also text messages and voice calls as well. So what is the mix? So that once you know that from your typical usage, you could then, buy that. Because the problem with the contract is, although you can sometimes change what you get under the contract, normally that change is only allowed in an upwards direction. So you can pay them more, but you usually can't pay them less. So the other benefit of going for a pay-as-you-go deal is that it enables you to work out what the coverage will be like, what the signal strength will be like for voice calls and for data, and it will be different for those two. You know, sometimes you'll be in an area where you get good quality calls, but the data is slow or non-existent, and sometimes it can be the reverse of that. So again, if you try it, what you need to do is to make your initial choice. You should use the network coverage maps that are published by each of the major networks. So, you know, EE, O2, Vodafone, whatever. They will allow you to put an address or a postcode in, and it will give you an indication, and it's only a rough indication, of how strong the signal is likely to be in those locations. So maybe at home, at your work address, anywhere where you think you're going to be often using the device. Ofcom also have a similar map, which is based on different data. Now, I have to tell you, these maps are an indication, but can often be wildly incorrect. So it's just a place to start to say, okay, you know, I'm going to try it with this network first. And just be prepared after a month or two, or even less if the signal's really poor, just to dump that particular SIM and go for another supplier.
Alan, does that help you out?
Is the Galaxy being replaced, the Tab S2?
Yes. I mean, I think the S2 has actually already been replaced.
But, has it? What has it been replaced by, if I may ask?
I don't know. I haven't seen it, but I think that I wouldn't worry too much about it, in the sense that... Any tablet that you buy is, you know, even from the point of release, is not that far away from the next one. The more important question is arguably, does it meet the needs that I have today, and will it likely meet them in for the next 2 or 3 years, or however long you intend to keep the device? You can do some research. I can certainly look into for you what will come next, but in a way, you know, even if it wasn't currently being replaced, it will not be that far away. Many manufacturers replace twice a year, others once a year. So you're never going to be, even straight after something is released, it's not necessarily going to be around that long as a current model. But that's not in and of itself a bad thing.
Alan in Glasgow, thank you very much indeed for your call. You can call us as well, 0500 909 693, to speak to Febsy with all your tech problems. Any recommendations you want for a particular product you're looking for, he can help out between now and three here on Up All Night. Peter is in Cramlington in Northumberland. Hi there, Peter.
Good morning, Richard.
Hi.
Morning, Febsy.
You've got a situation with a new laptop with quite a small hard drive. What's the situation?
I think it's called a cloud book. I've got 1 terabyte of cloud and 32 gig hard drive. Now, yeah. I know nothing about the cloud, so I thought that I could put all my programs in the cloud, but not so.
No.
Can I just expand the hard drive by shoving a SD card in?
It won't. Well, first of all, let's take one step back, Peter. As you've discovered, cloud storage, which means basically the ability to store your files on the internet, on a server somewhere on the internet, that's great for data files. So that can be music, it can be movie files, it can be Word documents, it can be spreadsheets, it can be anything like that. And it can be programs, but they can't be run from there. They even if you stored a program up in the cloud, which is not a typical use, it wouldn't really do you any good there, because the only place that's really useful for that is on the internal hard drive, and then it's loaded into the RAM memory to actually run it on the machine. So the cloud storage is useful if you're happy with storing your data on the cloud. There are some privacy considerations in doing that. In terms of how to expand the 32 gigabytes, if you have an SD card slot, yes, you can certainly put an SD card into it, and again, it will allow you to store files and so forth on it. However, SD cards are not meant as replacements for hard drives. For one thing, they are a lot slower than even a conventional hard drive, and most of them will not survive being written to and read from, you know, so very frequently in the way that a hard drive is. They are more designed for, you know, digital cameras where you know, you will store a picture and then another picture, but not smashing away at the device every second or two, you know, in the way that a hard drive gets accessed. So that leaves you with whether that 32 gigabyte drive can be replaced, and that depends on the specific make and model of the device that you have.
I've been told it can't.
You've been told you can't. Okay.
Yeah.
What is the make and model of the?
It's an Acer Aspire 1.
Acer Aspire 1. Okay. Well, I'll happily look at that for you, Peter. But if you've been, I mean, often with these devices, and particularly the 32 gig ones, they're not designed to be opened up. And even if you do, you may void your warranty. And is it a device that's currently under the warranty?
Yeah, I totally bought it this week.
Yeah. How did you buy it? How did you pay for it?
I walked into a shop.
Right. Okay. Does that shop give you the right to return it within a certain period or not once you've fired it up?
I don't know. Can I name the shop?
Yes.
I'm not complaining about them. It was Currys Dixon's, Currys PC World.
Mm. And did you pay over £100 for it?
Yes.
Did you pay by credit card?
No, I paid by a gift card, and then the rest of it was on debit card.
Yeah, okay, so you don't have protection on the Consumer Credit Act. So, all right, I wouldn't be opening that up to upgrade it at this point, because you're going to void your warranty. It's not designed to be upgraded in that way. Plus, it depends on how that drive is dealt with. It could be a solid state drive that's been soldered directly onto the motherboard, in which case, even if you open the machine, you can't upgrade it. I would say to you, if that drive is not big enough for your needs, and it would not be big enough for most people's needs.
All I've put on it is Kaspersky, Advanced System Care, and Skype, I think, and now it won't let me upgrade to Windows 10.
Yeah, And that's because although that's all you've put on it, the Windows operating system is sitting on it as well.
Yeah.
And look, I think you're kind of, to an extent, in the hands of the retailer, and the retailer would be within their rights in terms of consumer law to refuse you a refund. Did you tell them when you were buying it what you wanted to use it for?
I don't think I did.
So it's going to be harder for you to argue that it doesn't meet an intended purpose that they would have been aware of or should have been aware of. So I think you need to speak to them and see if they will allow you to swap it for something else. Even if it's costing, you know, maybe they'll charge you a restocking fee. You know, sometimes companies will charge 10% or so to take something back. And yeah. I would look at something a little bit more conventional. How much did you spend?
I think it was 150.
150. So the problem with this is, Peter, that you probably got quite good value for money out of your £150.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, if you were to shop around and spend maybe 200, you could get a more conventional laptop with a conventional hard drive in it, which
yes.
even though that hard drive may not be as fast as the 32 gigabyte, it will be a standard 2.5-inch hard drive, which
yes.
can, which first of all will have a higher capacity, which is obviously what you need, but also in the future can be upgraded. And the cost of solid state drives, the ones without the rotating parts inside it, the moving parts, though the cost of those drives continues to plummet. So you know, a few months in or a year in, you could get someone to upgrade it for you. Maybe after the end of the warranty period, you could get someone to upgrade it for you. For you know, by then, for what's probably going to be about £30, £40 plus the cost of doing the work, and you'll end up with something that's going to last you, you know, a long time. The £150 is not bad value for money, but as you've already discovered, you can hardly add anything to it, and once you
yeah.
do, it won't even allow you to go to Windows 10. So
yeah.
I think in this case, I would. Why don't you say that, you know, we've spoken on the radio and we thought it would be a good idea if they offered a swap for you, maybe a voucher.
Do we have that authority? We'll see. Peter, I hope that helps out. Good luck with that. Peter in Cramlington in Northumberland with problems.
Peter, come on in a couple of weeks and tell us how you got on.
I will.
All okay. right, that's great. Well, we look forward to speaking to you then. Thanks very much indeed for your call. You can call us to 0500 909 693 for your tech problems. Febsey Turkelps here from GadgetDetective.com. Don't forget, of course, this hour's available as a podcast if you go online and search for Let's Talk About Tech. First texter of the night. We've had a couple of calls, so haven't got a chance to read the text yet. But Kay in Crewe, Febsey, asks the following. Would you please explain about using Wi-Fi in public places and the best way to do so? He says, previously you mentioned something about a tunnel, effectively, which I would appreciate clarification on.
Okay.
And, what's the best way to get online, Wi-Fi-wise, in public?
So obviously Wi-Fi is a way of connecting to the internet when you're either at home or in a public space. But if you're in a public space, then you are, in effect, on a public network. And the problem with that is that what you're doing online may not be as private as you think it is. And that can also, by the way, apply to, you know, in a hotel room or a hotel lobby as well, even where you're paying for the Wi-Fi, it's hackable. So, and there are very simple tools that people can, you know, just download, and they can sniff around what you're doing, you know, on the plane, in the hotel or in the coffee shop. The way to avoid that is to use what's called a virtual private network, also known as a VPN. And that's the reference that I was making, I think, previously to a tunnel, because in non-technical terms, what it essentially does is it creates a tunnel between you and the website that you're speaking to or the server that you're communicating with. So it's a tunnel that allows the flow of information to and from that other point between you and the other party, but without anybody else on that Wi-Fi network, or in fact elsewhere on the internet, being able to easily penetrate it. Now, nothing is impossible, but the VPN network will give you a whole additional level of security, and you know, otherwise it's a bit like writing on a notepad in a cafe in such a way that everyone can read it. All they need to do is just have a look over your shoulder, and it's very easy to do. People can get software that very, very easily allows them to see what you're doing, which is why if you're not on a VPN network, you should certainly not be doing anything like entering passwords or accessing financial websites or shopping websites, because you're really opening yourself up to problems if you do that. And it's very tempting. And also bear in mind, often in places which have free, in quotes, free Wi-Fi, you know how we said nothing is for free, and if it is for free, sometimes you're the product.
Yeah.
Often when you sign up for this free Wi-Fi access in a pub or a cafe or a bar, wherever it is, if you were to read the terms of service for this free Wi-Fi...
Which no one does,
because for one thing, you're on a mobile connection and you're trying to get something done, and it's often tiny, and you're on a smartphone, and, you know, who's going to read a multi-page document? But often... The terms of service allows them to snoop on what you're doing as well. You know, and again, collect data. They may wish to sell it. They may wish to use it for their own marketing purposes. You may need to give them a good deal of information yourself before you're even allowed access to it. So personally, I try not to, unless I'm really stuck, I try not to use public Wi-Fi at all.
Is 4G better? Is it better just to just stay on your 4G network?
It is better in that you're not on an open network in the way that you are with a public Wi-Fi. So it is better in that regard, but it is still hackable, in, you know, albeit slightly with slightly greater degree of difficulty, and therefore a VPN is still advisable. Frankly, if you're on a wired connection, there are still benefits to VPNs. It all depends on how much you value your privacy and how you feel about the possibility of being hacked. Some people don't worry so much about those things and take the view that, well, you know, if money is stolen from their account, the bank will refund them. That's not a view that I take, but some people are let's say a bit more relaxed about these things. I think a VPN is a good thing, but as we've mentioned before on this program, there is almost always contention between security and privacy on the one hand, and convenience on the other hand. Accessing the internet through a virtual private network is slightly less convenient than not. Okay, it's not the end of the world, but it's just another hoop that you have to jump through, and therefore people often don't bother with it.
From VPNs to home theatres, Gil is in Newport in Wales. Hi there, Gil.
Good morning, Fabsy. Good morning, Richard.
Hi there. You have a problem with your home theatre.
My question, Fabsy, is in certain installations, this is what I've been told.
Mm-hmm.
In certain installations such as mine, it is an advantage to put through a DVI-D signal, mm-hmm, rather than the HDMI. So really my question is, would it pay me to go to someone like Electropax, for instance, and purchase a HDMI to DVI-D converter? I think they're about £200 or something. And I would also get the Sony Philips audio out on that as well.
Yeah.
Okay. Is there any benefit and advantage?
All right. Let me perhaps just explain the question that you've asked for the benefit of our listeners who may not be aware of, you know...
And me as well.
..what the meaning of that is. Okay, so this is a question about the way in which we transfer audio and video information from its source, be it an HD player of some sort, to a screen and speaker system. And both HDMI and DVI-D are digital, which is a good thing. The essential difference with them is that HDMI carries everything that the DVI signal carries, but it also carries the sound, all on a single connector. So the benefit of having everything together on HDMI is convenience, and if you're plugging it straight into a TV set, then that's ideal, because you're using the internal speakers on potentially on the TV set and displaying it on the screen, and it's one cable and it's convenient. The disadvantage comes when actually that's not what you want to do, and you want to separate it out. So you want to feed the audio into a home theatre amplifier, which will take just perhaps just the sound, or a standard amplifier to take the sound and push it out to speakers. So if you need to separate out the two because the sound is going to one box and the picture to another, then it's better to have a DVI cable on its own and the sound cable separately. But if it's all going to one box, or you're happy with, you know, putting both into one box and then taking the audio out again, that will tend to reduce the quality a little bit because it's going through one extra machine, and every device it goes through will tend to reduce the quality a little bit. Whether you can hear the difference is another question, but in theory, you know, it's the pinnacle of quality is achieved by sending a signal directly to its destination, not daisy chain it through other devices. So that's the difference. I wouldn't, because these cables are all digital, although I wouldn't say go out and buy the cheapest, you know, £2 cable, there's also a lot of rubbish talked about, you know, gold-plated cables and so forth, which for digital signals...
Not in my system.
Right, okay. But bear in mind, some people will spend... In my view, mistakenly, hundreds and, believe me, even thousands of pounds on a cable. And when it is digital, yes, you don't want the cable falling apart because then it won't work properly. You don't want the pins to get stuck inside and not come out and, you know, all this. It has to be physically sound. It has to have the right physical quality, so it shouldn't be too rigid. You should be able to, you know, flex it in the way that you want. So there is, you know, something worth paying for, but you're not going to get differences in the sound quality. Either that digital bit will arrive or it will not. And once it's digital, it should arrive. So don't be spending huge sums of money on this, you know.
Gil, does that help out?
Yes, certainly, but I wouldn't necessarily agree with Fabsy on the cable issue.
Mm-hmm.
Not if you're spending big bucks on a projector, for instance, as you would if you were buying a high-end, say, a Linsondex player, LP player, then you would want to spend a lot of money on the cartridge. Otherwise, you'd be wasting the quality. The same with the projector. If you're putting if you have a projector, you need to put an excellent signal into that projector. Otherwise, you're throwing your money away on the technology that you spent on the projector, on the display device.
Yeah, absolutely. The source of a signal is probably the most important thing. So, if you're thinking of, let's say, conventional hi-fi in the old days, you used to say, you know, put the money nearest the source. You spend the most money on the CD player or the DVD player and less on the speakers. Yeah, because if the quality, if a high quality signal doesn't reach the speakers in the first place, then there's no point having exemplary speakers. That is true. But what I'm talking about is the cables, the interconnect, and you don't. No cable can introduce additional quality. So the money should go into the source, whatever it is, and you should just make sure that you haven't got such a poor...
I think to a degree, Fabsy, to a degree. I bought a cord cable. I bought a... when I bought the system, first of all, I think I spent about £40 on a cable. And then I bought a cord.
Yeah.
And that was about 85, and I did notice a difference. I did notice an upping of the performance and also a little more detail. But I agree with you. To spend thousands on something from somebody like Wireworld, for example, where you could they ask £500 a meter. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, I think that audio beauty is in the ear of the beholder, and if you can hear the difference, or you believe you can, then fine, you know, spend the money on it. But you know, if it's a difference between 10, 30, 40, or £80, fair enough. But please, you know, don't go any further than that, because even if you can hear the difference, you also have to say, well, what difference would I hear if I put that money elsewhere into that setup?
Gil in South Wales, thanks very much indeed. Barry in Shrewsbury's called us as well. Hi there, Barry.
Hi, how are you doing?
Oh, very well, thanks, very well. You have a network router problem.
Yeah, to an extent. This is, I suppose, it's a question coming from an 8-year-old grandson. I'll make it as quick as possible. two in a landscape in the garden, the grandson sitting out with his iPad and wants to know why he can't get a connection. So, question being, Febsy, two exact same routers, connect them together to extend the range, just wondering the best way around it without one cutting the other out.
So you want to be able to use both routers at the same time for independent data streams, is that right? So you've got two internet connections, or you want to use a second router to boost the range of the first?
If I can try and use both of them together would be a help, but not necessarily. You don't have to.
Okay.
If it's whichever's the easiest way around, or just extending the Wi-Fi.
So if the problem is that you've got a Wi-Fi router and the range on the Wi-Fi router is not good enough, then there are a number of potential ways of solving that problem. One is that you buy what's called a Wi-Fi repeater, which sits sort of typically halfway between you and the router, picks up the signal and rebroadcasts it. So it's a bit like, Chinese whispers that someone will hear what I say and then shout it on, in a particular direction. So it can do that. You can buy that, or if you've got a second router and a bit of know-how, you can actually reconfigure the second router to act as a repeater, because it has all the electronics of the repeater in it. It just has to be configured correctly. So you can do it in that way. Another way is that the people get around the problem is that they use devices called home plugs, which I'm not sure how well that would work for you if you're talking about a garden environment. But in general terms, a home plug is a device that comes as a pair of devices. One plugs into the mains wiring near the router, and the data goes via an Ethernet cable into the home plug. The data is then sent over the mains wiring system, pops up at another mains plug, where the other one converts it back into an internet Wi-Fi signal, if that's what you want. And therefore, you can actually traverse large distances and have Wi-Fi remotely, not by sending the Wi-Fi through the air, but by turning it into an electrical signal for a period, sending it along the mains wiring, and then reversing the process at the other end. So,
no, I do have a set of them. I've got one plugged into the router at home, in the house, and one is into the shed that I use, shed garage, which runs my diagnostic laptop that I use for the cars, for the maintenance work.
Yeah.
Would I be able to plug the second router via that connection to extend the Wi-Fi?
Yeah, you can. You can do that, and you can also configure the second router as a switch, because you don't need to have two routers working as routers on the same system. That can cause problems. The other thing that I was going to mention to you is the router itself. Some routers have got an inherently better range than others. So, for example, most routers work on 2.4 gigahertz frequency, but there are some that will also work on 5 gigahertz. The 2.4 gigahertz is able to reach further than the 5 gigahertz, but the 5 gigahertz has some other advantages. So it's worth seeing what frequency your router is working on, and also bear in mind that some routers allow you to have directional signals, so it actually beams the Wi-Fi not equally in every direction but in a particular direction, a bit like a loudspeaker facing one way being louder in one direction than the other. It can point the Wi-Fi for you. So if you were wanting to spend money, then that's another way that you could possibly do it, is just to get a better router that's designed to cover longer distances.
Barry in Shrewsbury, thank you very much indeed for your call. Ruth is in Thanet in Kent. She called us on 0500 909 693. Hello there, Ruth.
Oh, hello.
Hi. You've got a problem with a laptop.
Yes, I have a disk read error.
Okay.
When is it
happening? Get out of it.
When's it happening? When does it occur?
Well, I went to switch. I've been using the laptop in the morning. In the afternoon, I went to switch it back on, and up come the disk read error, and it won't do anything.
Okay, so this is a Windows laptop?
Yes, it's but it's XP.
It's Windows XP. Okay,
so it's quite old then.
Yes.
Okay. Ruth, do you use this XP laptop to access the internet?
Well, I did, yes.
Okay, and do you no longer do that?
Well, no, because I also have a small HP Envy that I use normally. It's just some of the programs that are on my laptop.
Yes.
I like to use, and I can't.
I understand. Okay, so just a word of warning. Windows XP is no longer supported by Microsoft, and what that means is that as new faults and vulnerabilities in the XP operating system are discovered, and these vulnerabilities are those that leave you open to being hacked and otherwise attacked by digital miscreants.
Yeah.
Those weaknesses will no longer and are no longer being patched by Microsoft. So, you know, you are at some risk in that if that machine goes onto any sort of network in particular, you know, even a Wi-Fi network at home, you're at some risk. So I would say to you that, you know, either you would retire that machine and thank it for its long service, or upgrade at least to something like, you know, Windows 7, or you could possibly.
Well, on my Envy, I have Windows 8.1, so
yeah.
That's the one I use for most of my internet work. It's just that there's some things on the laptop that I would like to get off.
I understand. I just wanted to flag that with you because even though it's not your main machine, it could represent a weak link in your security. And if they share a common network, for example, it would be potentially possible for someone to hack the old machine and then access the data on the new one if they were ever connected together on the same Wi-Fi network. So just be aware of that. That's, you know, a warning for you as well as anyone else who's still using Windows XP. With regard to the disk read error you mentioned, does it actually stop the machine from starting up altogether? Or does
that's all that comes on the screen.
It says disk read error. Okay. So there's two possibilities. Either the data that's written to the drive has been corrupted, which can happen over time because, you know, hard drives typically have magnetic storage media.
Yeah.
And they're susceptible to everything, including, would you believe, cosmic rays that, you know, rays from space will occasionally hit your hard drive and just cause a random sort of corruption or mutation on your hard drive. So that can happen. If you're lucky, it's just, you know, a corruption which can be fixed with a repair. So if you have your Windows XP disk, you can pop it into the CD or DVD drive on the computer and execute a repair, whereby, in theory at least, it should reinstall Windows, leaving all your data intact. If you don't have that disk, or if you do and that doesn't work.
I have a recovery disk.
Right. The problem with a recovery disk as opposed to a plain Windows XP disk is it may or may not allow you to do an in-situ repair of the operating system without damaging the surrounding data. A recovery disk will typically take you back to an image of the hard drive as it was on the day the machine was new.
Yes.
That is to say, with none of your data on it, you know, because it will, you know, just wipe over the top of it. If there is data on there which is, you know, valuable to you, I don't mean programs that can be reinstalled, but let's say photographs or video clips or you know, your unpublished novel or something like that that you need to get off, then the best, most reliable way of doing that is, and this might, you know, require the intervention of someone with a bit of expertise, but it is to actually physically remove the hard drive from inside the old computer and, using a basic interface, connect it via USB to the new computer and copy off what you can. And hopefully it will work. It depends if there's physical damage to the hard drive itself.
Ruth in Thanet in Kent, thanks very much indeed. Just finally, Febsy, we had Ian, a caller in Hull in East Yorkshire. He says he's got a problem with his Skybox. Can he copy recordings across from an old one to a new one very quickly before 3 a.m.?
Not easily, because this is all DRM protected by Sky, so they make it very, very hard to do that. No, it's not an easy thing to do or advisable.
On digital and online.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
bbc.co.uk/5live.